Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line Podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, your butt at the party.
And Jake Latondras.
I am bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line Podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur, sitting in the Duck South Studios. And alongside me today is, gosh, you're way out west, Ramsey. In
yes,
the
sir.
Box. What kind of
Reno,
mate,
Nevada.
That place?
Man, it's you know, Rocky, I'll be honest with you. Listen, folks, it's a terrible duck season back home for Ramsey Russell. We've killed some ducks, but I was real, real glad that convention season rolled around like it did. Normally, we go to Dallas first, and then we go to Reno or Vegas, SCI. This year, they crunched them both, bam, bam, right together. So for the next 2 weeks, we're working. I'm glad to be here. You know, this coming out west is this is a really, really nice show. If you can imagine, it's the largest hunting show on earth. Just imagine 10 solid acres of hunting booth. And I've seen everything from Marcor to beagle chased rabbit hunts at these shows. And some of the most elite artwork, man, there's some bronze statues laying around, you know. If you got to ask, you can't afford it, but some of these statues go for six figures. It's incredible. It's just an incredible hunting show, and we do real well here. Make a lot of contact with a lot of the Western market out in California and the West Coast. But look, yesterday morning, I'm in Reno, Nevada, and yesterday morning, the show opened at 10 o'clock, and before noon, we had been swamped. I mean, all hands on deck swamped by people from California, Indiana, New York, Mississippi. I mean, just all over. You know, people fly to come to this show. Just somebody actually knew, but it was absolutely. People fly to go on vacation to come to this show, buy a hunt. You know, but like we had a guy from Montana come in. And, I mean, this is right when the show started. Boom, I'm sitting down talking to somebody that knew us, knew our reputation, was talking about all that, just come and had a seat, want to start talking Argentina. Looks like he's going to go on. And he knew everything about the hunt he wanted to go on and was ready to go. And then Marshall says, Ramsey, this guy wants to buy a king eider hunt. I stood up, shook his hand. He's like, yeah, I know all about you. I've been researching you. I want to go these dates 2 years from now. Boom, check. It's the most incredible show, and I enjoy it. We really enjoy it. Chris Wujic from Michitobe Outfitters comes down and works with us. Marcus Ciafone from Argentina comes up and works with us, and it's all hands on deck. We got a nice display and just have a real good time and meet a lot of hunters. You know, meet a lot, and you know, I was surprised. I can't remember who it was because it's just an ocean of humanity, but. Somebody started talking about the podcast, you know, so people are listening to this podcast apparently. And yesterday, I scheduled it before I left, not really thinking about a date. You know, the way we have to release stuff online, I'm never sitting at a computer at home too long. You know, we released our Life Short Get Ducks Australia feature finally. A lot of people I've been getting texts and emails, even Forrest asking about it. When are you going to release it? What are you going to do with it? Forrest had never seen it till it come out yesterday. I didn't show just everybody. But you know, when we let out that little trailer, it had GetDucks.com presents. And somehow or another, the algorithm from Facebook picked it up. and put us in a little black box under the counter in a dark room and said, nope, nobody's going to see this. And the reason they cited was because it went to a landing page, getducks.com. In other words, that video led people to a page that had firearms on it, Benelli. And, you know, a Benelli ad. And, man, they just put the hiatus on us. Well, that hurt my feelings just a little bit. I ain't going to lie to you, because that didn't have nothing to do with a hunt. That was just about me and my story. And that really hurt my feelings. Well, Jake and I went back through some of the pieces we put together, through the feature piece, and we just removed the .com. And I know it's been live now for about 17 or 18 hours, and it's getting some traction. It seems to be doing pretty darn good. If y'all haven't seen it, check it out. I know Rocky posted up on Duck South, and I'd appreciate everybody just sharing it and posting it or tagging people that think might be interested. And one thing I warn everybody is that, you know, we've got a pipeline of destinations coming, and we're trying to present something, Rocky, in a real, real different format. We've gone back and forth. We've talked to some people. We've talked to some sponsor types. You know, we've really done our due diligence in this thing. And at the end of the day, we're right back where we started. The vision that I had when I called Jake Latondres, I said, Jake, I got a face for radio. I don't want to be a star. I don't have an ego to feed. I want to tell a story. I want to tell a long, chronological, evolving story, a truth in duck hunting. I want to show people real duck hunting around the world, real people. In other words, I want the star to be the people that I'm in contact with around the world. Little Adil, my bird boy in Azerbaijan, David down in Argentina, Diego down in Argentina, you know, Glenn over in Australia, Trent down in Australia. I want the people, because no matter how funny they talk or what their religion is or what kind of economic strata they come from, they're duck hunters. And there's just universal truth in duck hunting that exists. And it just blows my mind that I can be sitting in a duck blind with people of all race, colors, religions, economics, and just skill sets and accents and everything else. And if they're duck hunters, we don't have to speak the same language. We're duck hunters. And it's just this thing, you know, and all these different bird species. I mean, there's people out there chasing the 41. Well, baby, look, there's 50 subspecies plus geese just in America, you know. But when you start stepping out across the border into the world, there's hundreds of waterfowl species, and even though the fundamentals are the same, set up in the habitat, it's almost like, Rocky, if you're a baseball player, and you know, you're a baseball player, a high production baseball player, and I used to think about quarterbacking like Archie Manning, you know. Archie and his boys, great quarterbacks, but you know, it's a business and it's everything else, but at some level, it's as fundamental as just tossing the ball to your daddy in the backyard. But then you start traveling around to all these playing fields, and the fields change, and you revert to your fundamentals of duck hunting to shoot red-crested poachers or rosy-billed poachers or pintails or scalp or you know, whatever, you know, bar-headed geese. You stick to the fundamentals in this whole great new stadium that you've never been to. And then you evolve a little bit. You up your skill set. You try something different. And that's just a real interesting story. I mean, we've done well in social media. We've done well building brand, because people that have never left their home county shoot nothing but wood ducks and mallards, they can relate to that. And that's the story we want to tell. And so as we explored different ways and distribution and different partnerships and everything else, I finally realized, you know, I don't want to get lost in the noise, because what happens too many times on TV and some of these different pursuits in video and everything else, you see, you know, the story gets lost in the money, in the industry. And I'm like, you know, Jake, I don't want to do this. I want to just tell this story in as much as I can afford to tell it as a part of our existing business model. But I don't want to taint the story by driving around the world looking like a NASCAR car, you know, with all these sponsors and having to push their story. I want to push my story. I want to push the story of duck hunting. And it's a lot of interesting stories, a lot of traditions and cultures and ethics, and very different than America sometimes. And I think that should be the story. I think the hunt and the hunted and the hunters, they should be the star of the show, not Ramsey Russell. So that's what we're trying to do, Rock. And you know, and because it's not scripted, because we don't have a format, you know, each destination is going to be different. And even the same destination twice, like we filmed Argentina. We've already done the field work for Argentina, a very remote location. Y'all have heard me talk about Rio Salado. I love it. And it was dry last year, and we did a story. And this year we're going back, and it is full to the brim, full of water, full of ducks. Everything, the magic of that marsh is alive, and we're going to do a different story. You know, but it's going to be the same location, and that's where we are with that. If y'all haven't seen it, check it out, share it, tag it. You know, help us get distributed. Because I've said it before. We've talked about anti-hunting. We've talked about the whole liberal politics of, you know, hunting hanging by a thread. And baby, it's no more evident than Facebook. If you think Facebook agrees with this stuff that we do, this duck hunting, you're wrong, baby. They don't like it. Some little blue-haired fairy-looking girl with a bone in her nose is sitting in a dark room in San Francisco somewhere in Silicon Valley running heavy-handed on what the message they're going to allow to get out on Facebook is. So it's kind of up to us to organically do it. You know, we've got a
room full of people. Facebook, yeah, that are going through all these
thousands
posts.
Of them. And they don't agree with guns, and they don't agree with bullets, and they don't agree with hunting dogs, and they don't agree with anything we do. You know, and so if you see something you like and believe in on Facebook or any social media format, man, share it, distribute it, get the word out. You know, we appreciate it, but it's doing good. You know, and I think that the reason that Australia story is making its way slowly and surely around the internet like it is, I think it's because duck hunters just, they can relate to it. Yeah, it's Australia. Yeah, it's a different species. Yeah, it's a different looking habitat. And everything else, but at the end of the day, it's duck hunting that everybody can relate to. And that's what, you know, so it's new on one hand, it's very, very new, you know, because it's Australia and there's kangaroos and pink-eared ducks and everything else. But on the other hand, it's duck hunting. It's as fundamental and familiar as calling mallards into timber. And so that's the kind of story we're going to tell with this thing right here. And for the next 4 days, I'll be in Reno, balls of the wall selling hunts and talking to folks about hunts and just doing what we do, man. It's duck season somewhere. And we're going to leave here. Some of the people, Chris and Nance, are man, they're going to leave here, I guess, Sunday or Monday and drive to Dallas. We'll pack our stuff up Sunday, crate it, and ship it to Dallas. I'm going home Sunday, ironing clothes, washing clothes, getting ready. And driving Monday back out to Dallas. We'll set up Tuesday, and we'll be ready for that show next week. And we laid out our plan for next year last night at dinner. Next year, we're probably going to do about a month stretch. We're going to do Dallas, Reno, probably Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and hopefully go to Nashville for NWTF, just do a full month of it. And so it's my time of year. It's what I do. It's really kind of the work part of what we do. You get to see me on social media, and we talk about a lot of these stories, doing the fun stuff. But really, it's kind of work stuff. But I enjoy it too. I you know, Rocky, I love people, and obviously I love to talk. And but I like to listen too. And when I'm there on the show floor, people come up and ask a lot of questions, a lot of specific details about these hunts. Because this, when you look at a collection of people that fly, it's one thing if I'm just going to drive 15, 20 minutes down the road to the Mississippi Trade Center to walk around and eat some buttered popcorn and, you know, talk to somebody about a hunt. But it's something else entirely different when a man leaves Indiana or Boston or Montana and flies to Reno, which is a very nice town. Kind of a sleepy cowboy town compared to Vegas. There's not the distraction. You know, when you go to Vegas, there's a million different things to do besides come to this hunting show. A lot of stuff competing for the attention of that hunting show. Here, there's not. People are here to go to this hunting show. And they're very knowledgeable and very experienced and usually very, very well-traveled hunters. And they've already done their research, man. We probably already talked on the phone. And if not, they've been all over the internet and read our stuff, and they know, and they know what questions they want to ask. And so, but at the same time, as you're getting to know people like you do when you're meeting with them talking about these hunts, you get to listen. And it's always interesting to hear their stories from these guys that have been, you know. Now here's the deal. A lot of these guys are big game hunters too. It's very rare that somebody comes to my booth at these shows that is just a bird hunter. You know, Rocky, some of the big game collections these people have amassed is just jaw-dropping stunning. It's unbelievable. And one day they woke up, maybe they were older, and they didn't have the mobility to go climb the mountains and shoot the murkhors and the sheep and the ibex. Or maybe they'd done it, and they realized, hey, you know, oh, these birds sure do sparkle and pop. Man, wouldn't they look good in my game room, too? And it sets them off on a whole new journey of collection. And again, like myself, I think a lot of these guys, they collect animals, you know, trophies. But at the same time, you hear it when they're talking to you. Same as me, that what they really collect are experiences. They really collect experiences, you know, and I'll tell everybody, there's a bunch of dead birds around my place, but they're just placeholders for memories for me. You know what I'm saying? I tell my kids all the time, look, these are just stuffed birds. They don't mean anything to anybody but me. You know, when I die or when I retire or whatever, you know, y'all are welcome to back up that big green dumpster and toss out everything you don't want. You know what I'm saying? They just mean something to me. They're just where I can sit and look at my stuff and remember, oh, yeah, I forgot all about that time I was up on that mountain shooting those bar-headed geese. You know, it's kind of that kind of stuff, you know, and collectors of experiences is what a lot of these people are. And I'll tell you this little story, Rocky, getting into, you know, my backstory. You may remember, or maybe I didn't mention, but, you know, I went to Mississippi State University chomping at the bits to be a deer biologist. Man, you know, Harry Jacobson was a hero. Jim Kroll, Dr. Deer, you know, I grew up in that era. And I wanted to be a white-tailed deer biologist. That's what I wanted to do. That was my ambition. Out of high school, I really hunted a lot more deer than I did ducks. Ducks were just something I did when a cold front blew and I walked by a beaver pond, it was full of mallards or saw them rafted up somewhere, you know, I'd go chase some ducks a little bit. But, man, I wanted to be a deer biologist. And I went to Mississippi State University. And the reason makes me kind of, the reason I thought of this, because I'm walking around, you know, 10 acres of some of the most incredible, I mean, name an animal on God's earth that has hunted. And there's one heck of a taxidermist player, 50, sitting at this show. Just incredible taxidermy of all these big games. So I'm walking around, man. I'm telling you, I love my birds, but it's hard not to want to go shoot some of these animals. You know, like very few people know that on my 50th birthday, my wife said, you know, she wanted to do something big. I'm like, well, you know. And I found a deal on an Africa hunt. And, you know, I duck hunt for a living. I duck hunt for work. And I explore and I do all this stuff. But, you know, if I go on vacation, like one time I was giving a presentation to a Lions Club or Rotary Club or something. And I got this little presentation, this little slideshow, duck season somewhere, and we run around the world, you know, and talk about some stuff. And it's a little organic. So, but anyway, at the end of the presentation, a little old man raised his hand and said, you do all this stuff, but like, what would it be? How did he ask that question? He said, what's your trip of a lifetime? You've done all this stuff, so what would be your trip of a lifetime? Where do you want to go for vacation? I said, oh, you know, next question. I don't even deserve an answer. You don't want to hear that. It'd be boring. No. They, you know, where do you want to go for vacation? What was your trip of a lifetime? I said, man, I want to go somewhere and not shoot ducks. That's what I want to do for vacation. I don't want to shoot ducks. But I do like to hunt. On my 50th birthday, we found a deal. I mean, a heck of a deal, man. We just worked through some friends, worked through some networks, and my wife and I went to Africa. Went to South Africa, and it was a lot. It reminded me so much of when I was in my early 20s, about forest age, and I worked down in South Texas. You know, we high-racked. We saw this wildlife. I broke out my belt, this 300 Magnum I've had since 1989, it's like the finger of God when I pull the trigger. You know, stuff just falls. I had a wonderful time. And you know, look, and I didn't bring heads back to get mounted. I didn't even care if we had anything at all. We shot kudu and eland. And my wife had never hunted a day in her life. And leading up that trip, I started her off with a little 17 HMR. She had a good shot. Got a 270, you know, got it sighted in with that bullet we were going to shoot, and let her pull the trigger three times. Didn't want her to get a recoil flinch. Man, she aced it, man, bullseye, three shots in a row. And then we brought her over here to Africa, and she shot three animals. She was proud as could be, dropped them dead in their tracks. You know, one of them was a blood bucket, about 250 yards, just killed it, dead on the wedge. People don't know that, you know, but I like to big game hunt some. I just don't have time to do it as much as I like. I don't have money to do some of this big stuff they sell here at the show to do it like I'd like. But when I went to Mississippi State University, my ambition, get a degree in wildlife, get a job on a ranch maybe become a PhD and do wildlife, whitetail deer research. And I never will forget, I was at Mississippi State University my first semester, and I was in biology lab, and we were dissecting earthworms. I can remember that. My lab partner was named Jeremy. I never really got to know him too good because he's one of those students that came in as a freshman and was going to be in wildlife, and just somewhere between there and summer camp, he dropped. I don't know if he swapped majors or just dropped out of school. I don't remember, but I never will forget. As we were dissecting them dumb earthworms, he started telling me about this job he'd applied for. He said, man, it's unbelievable. I'm going to go down to South Texas, and they're actually going to pay me money, and I'm going to manage whitetail deer, and we're going to build a plant food plot, and I got to shoot a bunch of does, and we're going to do all this stuff. And I'm like, man, I need that job.
That's what I was going to say.
I was sitting, man, he's sitting there telling me about it, and my head's spinning going, that sounds like a job I need. And he said, well, you got to go down there to co-op. He said, it's just right down there on Engineering Alley. And where do you think I left? I mean, the minute that South African grad student that ran that lab cut us loose, where do you think I went? I grabbed my book bag and went straight to the co-op office, walked in and said, I want to apply for a job to do this. And he gave me my paperwork. I went home that night. And I made an application and just did everything, you know, and went back and dropped it off. And I don't know, 2-3 weeks later, I was walking down, going to a class or something in the wildlife building. Dorman Hall is where forestry and wildlife at the time. And Harry Jacobson started, hey, Russell. Man, I didn't know Dr. Jacobson from nobody. Except I knew who he was, you know, but I didn't know he knew me from nobody. And I said, yes, sir. And he goes, come here and talk to this guy. I got on the phone, and it was that biologist down in Texas. And he had called Dr. Jacobson to see if he knew me. Said he liked my application. And I got on the phone with him. And I don't remember what all we talked about. But I remember he told me, he said, can you start? I said, yes, sir. Now, look, this was – the start date would have been right after that big bike ride we did. Because this was a semester – leading up to that bike ride. And I'm like, yes, sir. And my brother was getting married in early August. And I knew I had to be home for it. I was the best man, couldn't miss it. And I said, well, I can come down right after that wedding, which will be, right into about the early second week of August. And he said, he's fine, you're hired. He said, but I'm going to warn you. He said, you need to leave your upbringings, everything your granddaddy taught you, you need to leave it at home. This is whitetail, this is intensive whitetail deer, trophy whitetail deer management, South Texas. And all that kind of stuff, I want you to leave it home, and I want you to come down here open-minded, and I want you to do what we tell you to do, okay? I said, yes, sir. I got the job. I'm coming to Texas, That was one of the most incredible experiences of my life. It was, I had shot some deer back home. What he meant about that, my granddaddy upbringing, I can tell you this, Rocky, I grew up hunting in around Inverness, Mississippi with my granddaddy. My granddaddy was a very practical man. He was old school. He was an old attorney. Comfortable, but old school and practical, and just that if you kill it, you eat it mentality. And a lot of my friends on the dove field were breasting doves and going on about their business. Oh, heck no, man, we picked our doves. Recipe my granddad, how he liked to cook doves, he plucked them. Gutted them, and he had the whole little carcass. Same with ducks. There wasn't no breast meat floating around, baby. He plucked the whole thing. It wasn't no big deal. That's what we did. But you ate it. He's a good cook. And we show up down in South Texas, and marching orders, man. I started off on a 107,000-acre ranch about 30 miles north of the Mexican border. That ranch sprawled across three counties, or parts of three counties that have been known since the dawn of time as producing Boone and Crockett deer. Low fence, not high fence. It was owned by a couple of Texas oil barons, a couple of brothers oil barons. I mean, money beyond my imagination at the time. And, very practical people, but nonetheless, they traded and dealt in ranches like kids like me would swap baseball cards. The ranch we started on, that 107,000-acre ranch, as far as I know, their great-great-granddaddy killed Apache Indians to put that piece of land together. I mean, I don't know. It's just been the family forever. It was their home ranch. But then they had a lot of satellite ranches. They ran cattle on this thing, but it wasn't like running cattle in Mississippi or other parts of Texas. We see all the grassy plains, son. This was brush country. It was brasada. It was a lot of mesquite, and everything down there would cut you or bite you. Rattlesnakes galore, and thorns and cacti and just mesquite trees. So the grazing was less, and the carrying capacity for deer was less. But it was in very, very productive soil. This would have been 1990, and the 2 years I worked down there on those ranches for this guy was the fourth and fifth consecutive years of above average precipitation, which made that dry parched desert like landscape extremely productive. And so I got to be down there in year four and five of what a fawn that had been dropped had benefited from above average precipitation. You follow what I'm saying? It's right. Like every year of this buck's life was above average precipitation, so it was a lot more browse, and his potential for antlers was just incredible. Rocky, we found a pair of shed antlers one time, stacked on top of each other. Now look, on 107,000 acres, there was 3,000 acres around headquarters. They called it a pasture. But you just look at a map, and there, 3,000 acres, don't shoot nothing. Out here, marching orders were shoot does. And two of them boys, or four of us co-op students, two of them boys, you know, upper seniors or juniors, they didn't give a mess about nothing, you know. We get done working out in the field, fixing windmills and hanging barbed wire and planting food plots, whatever we had to do out there. And they wanted to go back and sit around the house. Me and my old buddy Rodney, not us, baby, we was out there. You know, we go find something to do, fishing and stock tanks or whatever have you. And it was so incredible. Now, we couldn't shoot buck. Oh, heck no, son, not unless you want to go to jail. You didn't shoot a buck on that place. And at the end of the year, if you did good as a reward, my boss, who to this day is one of the most foremost whitetail deer biologists, trophy deer biologists in the world, Mr. Bob Zaglin was his name. At the end of the semester, if you did good and did right for a bonus, he let us shoot a management buck, which had to be an old deer. An old down there ain't 5 years old. It was 7 or 8 years old. And, wow. And it had to be a slick eight. It had to be a slick eight. And Rocky, you know, it was, I lived a little, hand me down the cowboy, the cattle part was the big part of that. It was a cattle ranch. Okay. It's where they raised cattle. And so there was a family of Mexicans, and they were all brothers. And the span of years between the youngest and the oldest was, I'd guess 20 years. And they all, some of them had been grandfathered in, you know, from back in the day in terms of their citizenship. And they'd work, man, they would work, and they were such good people. And we kind of lived, us old co-op students, us college kids living like a hand-me-down house, you know, from them, from the cattle operating. Everything we had, like the pickup trucks we drove, had 200,000 miles on them and were hand-me-down from the oil operation and stuff like that. And, you know, flat tires were a part of life down that part of the world. Tractors, man, we would get so many antlers stuck in the wheels out there disking those food plots that, you know, just have to go out there and put it in the shop and break that thing down and fix it ourselves. It was work. I mean, for a white kid from Mississippi, you know, going to college, it was work, you know, hanging fence and putting fence through that stone soil. And, but gosh, it was wonderful. Rocky, right off the bat, we had to start shooting does. And no problem. I mean, and I never forget the old boy saying, he's in the look, you can't eat all these deer. I need deer killed. You can't eat them all. So eat what you want, by all means. I mean, y'all are co-op students making a whopping $500 a month, okay, and 30 miles behind a lock gate, which was 60 miles from the nearest town, which didn't even have a grocery store. It was about, it was even further to get to the nearest Walmart. And so, yeah, y'all need something to eat. Y'all eat all you can, but you can't eat all the deer I need killed. And you can't possibly. But do what you want, you know, and just antlerless deer have to be shot. And but one thing I know is we started planting those food plots, and
the reason being you were shooting so many does was a food.
Basic whitetail deer management, man. You want to put, right. You know, you've got X nutrition sitting on a piece of property, and the ideal of trophy management is to put that nutrient in the form of antlers, and so the more he has to eat, the more energy he had to put towards antlers.
That's right.
And you know, and the less does there are, the less mouths there are to feed. And
I got a question for you out of left field, real quick. Yeah, I got actually two questions. 1990, I remember. This is the first question. Very well, because I was huge in deer hunting at the time, and that in 1990 was somewhere right in there where Mississippi just started bringing their doe season back. We had just enough deer that we, you know, you were alive. I think we had two doe days in 1990.
It was that's back when we had like doe days. Yeah, doe days.
Yeah, and hell, yeah, and so. You didn't see a lot of deer in the woods. I mean, we had a great place. And I mean, if you went and saw 6 or 8 deer in a day, you know, in a day's worth hunting, that was a great hunt.
That's right.
But from what you're saying, it sounds like there was a ton of deer down there.
There was it was 107,000 acres ranch. And I think the helicopter surveys showed $1 per 300 acres. There were more does, and I know that that year, that semester, he told us to quit shooting deer, or to go way out to shoot deer because based on the helicopter survey flown around early November, I guess. He said, and the doe ratio, we got it real tight, real tight.
If you ever have to do a deer survey by a helicopter, you got a pretty nice place.
Oh, you dang right, son. You know, like the thing about that country, that mesquite stuff is you. After a while, your eyes got adapted to it. You could kind of see through it, you know, as you were. But when you first get there, it's like all you see is a thicket, and you can't really see through it. You can't see deer much very far in it. You can't see things in it, but your eyes get adapted to kind of looking through that cover. But once you get up, even on a high rack, on top of a truck, or let alone a helicopter survey, and you're looking down on it, it's like looking at the African savannah. It's like you can just see anything when you're up high. We flew helicopter some, and I got to ride up in there and look at deer and chase deer with it. And but that land was so big, like you know, all we had for a map. Understand, this is 1990. There wasn't internet. There wasn't Google. There wasn't GPS. Well, there were some stuff like that. Like one of the brothers had this big old white bubble on top of his truck. It was a Lorenz or something, they called it. He had this phone about the size of a cinder block, and he could talk to his buddy in Houston, Texas, from that ranch. I'd never seen nothing like this, man. This is like Richie Rich invention stuff. When to listen to a man be driving down a road and listen to a man break out this big 3-foot-long antenna on a box and start talking on like a telephone while we're in a pickup truck. I'd never seen nothing like it. Our map was about a 3x3. You'd have to stop and put it on the hood of your truck, and it was just a line map. Roads. All it was a blank piece of paper with hundreds of miles of senderos and little dots that were windmills. And so you'd be just out in a part of a ranch you ain't never been to, lost as Cooter Brown. I mean, you didn't know where you were. And what you did is get on top of the truck or just keep driving until you saw a windmill. And then go up to the windmill and see what the number said on it, and then find that dot on your 3x3 piece of paper and say, okay, I'm over here. And you know, talking about those brothers, let me tell you the story. You know, you go to rodeos, Dixie National, you see these professional cowboys, and you think cowboy. Man, let me tell you what. Think about a Mexican from old country Mexico and a pair of maybe cowboy boots, maybe high top, hand-me-down Reeboks. Been riding a horse since he was 2 or 3 years old. And just, I'm talking cowboy. His hands aren't even like hands. They're like tools. They're like steel. Where he can sit there and undo the braid of a lariat, you know, with his hands. Or do anything with his hands. It's almost like he can make a fist and pound a nail with them. They're so hard and tough and worked. But one of my favorite of those brothers, the one I remember, was the little brother, the baby brother, they got the next to baby brother, his name was Luis. Didn't speak a lick of English. But somehow or another, Luis's one of his foot, one of his legs was 6 inches shorter than the other one. He was a big man. I mean, real big belly guy.
Six inches is a lot.
It's a lot. And he had kind of a boot to kind of help things out, but his mobility was real, real bad. But because
he
what happened
high heels,
was,
though.
Well, I asked him one day because my job, Luis could fit. Look, man, that bull. We did a lot of habitat management, like root plowing. And drum chopping, you know, and it was for cattle and the deer benefited too. Well, my job I remember that semester, part of my job was there for a stretch of time. Luis was on a bulldozer, and that bulldozer had to be cranked every morning. I don't mean it had to be jump on top and turn the key. I mean it had to be beat on with a ball peen hammer and magic wand and sprinkled and blessed and everything else to get that thing running. And there was one man on the ranch, the equipment operator named Luis, that could make it run. And if we got stuck with our old John Deere tractor planting food plots, if we was in a bind and couldn't get it cranked, all we had to do was find Luis. He'd make us son of a gun run. I had old pocket knife. I never forget a solenoid was out or something, and to crank that tractor every morning, I had to take a piece of, I'd take my knife and make an arc somewhere on that starter. That's how Luis taught me to crank that tractor every morning. And I lost that pocket knife. I'd had that pocket knife forever, the old Victorinox pocket knife, little multi-tool, and I lost that thing. And when I lost it, it still had a big gash on the top of that blade from being burned so many times throwing that arc to crank that tractor. But
do you know how many memories you just struck up in my mind talking about that?
I mean, it's just, yeah, you know, it's
kids of the day that work on a farm or, you know, go drive a tractor on the weekends on their food plots, they don't understand what in the world you're talking about.
No, you just jump on that Kubota and turn the key. But, you know, back in those days, look, man, we were 30 miles down a dirt road from the gate. You know, there wasn't no, if it broke, you fixed it. If man, look, for a 20-year-old kid that didn't grow up on a farm, when once or twice a week, one of those great big 6-foot tires on that John Deere 4350 or whatever size tractor that was got a flat tire. There wasn't nothing to do but jack it up and get that tire off and run 15 or 20 miles back to the shop, which was just a steel building and had one of them old, you know what I'm talking about, not one of these hydraulic things, not one of these motorized wheel breaker downers, but you put it on there and got a big old cheek bar, and hopefully there was enough of you around the shop to break the seal.
Oh,
and that
God.
Was the easy part, is getting that son of a gun back on there that would about break you in half. But we did it. You know, that's just what you had to do, was get that tire off and plug it and patch it and put it back on and get back out there so you could keep on planting those food plots. Well, the reason Luis's leg was shorter than the other is because when he was a little boy in poor Mexico, a cowboy raised, I mean, it's like, I guess, those folks, it's like when they was old enough to get on a horse, somebody put them on a horse and said, giddy up, go round up cows. That's what we do. And Luis had been a little boy. And the best I could understand, I didn't think of him as a little boy, like 12. As he told me the story, and me not speaking Spanish, him not speaking English, I was sitting there sharing a sandwich, because my job was every day at lunch, I had to go find Luis down on whatever part of the ranch he was working on. I had to look at my map and windmills and go find him. And when I found him, he would have parked his truck where the bulldozer was and then taken off on the bulldozer. I had to find him, bring him back to his truck, and then he and I would go back to the bulldozer and find a shade tree and eat lunch. And then I'd head on back, you know, to whatever I had to do. And that's how I kind of caught him up, you know, so he didn't have to, man couldn't walk 5 miles to get back to his truck at the end of the day. And he just couldn't do it. And so that's how we kept progress going, you know, where he could get the next morning, start where he left. And but the reason his leg was busted up, because when he was a little boy, the horse had hit a hole and flipped over and it crushed his leg. About falling on this little, I mean, I'm guessing he's 5 or 6 years old to hear him tell the story, and it crushed his leg. And all his poor family could do was put him in the bed, hope he didn't die, until he could walk again. And that's why his leg was so much shorter. His leg just, it got crushed. And they just put him in a bed at home until the boy could get back on the horse. And
all right, Randy, you're making me feel bad for laughing about his 6-inch lip.
Well, I mean, he didn't care about it, but it was just his life, you know. And here's the, so some of his older brothers had been working on the ranch since the granddaddy's day or whatever, and they wanted to bring all the brothers on and to get Luis to the ranch, and this would have been, God, 50, 60 years ago, to get him to the ranch. They coordinated with whoever was the cattle foreman at the time for 3 or 4 days off, and they went down to Mexico and got their brother Luis, who couldn't walk like that, and smuggled him, swam him across the river, and snuck him into the country, and brought him to that ranch, and that's where they lived. And I mean, they brought him in this country because they needed an equipment operator, somebody that could do that, and they needed their brother, and they wanted their brother because them Mexicans are tight, man. They're family oriented folks, and that's how he got to this country. And that, and let me tell you the story. The name of this ranch was the Piloncilla. Now, it's just like the bottom of the ocean with a bunch of mosquitoes on it, but they're the highest escarpment cliff, you know, kind of where the big main house was, that the rancher's granddaddy's house, the big house they stayed in when they was on the ranch. And if you looked out to the west, out in the middle of the flat as a bottom of the ocean pancake landscape full of brush, there was a rock formation. I mean, a big formation sitting out there miles away. And it looked like if you took an old waffle cone, you know, big waffle ice cream cone, and stuck it upside down, that's what it looked like. Well, the name of that waffle cone in Spanish is Piloncilla. And so it was named after that rock formation. Well, that rock formation at the time was on a whole lot of maps, underground maps that wetbacks used when they immigrated across the Rio Grande River into our country of work. And that ranch, I mean, Border Patrol would run some of our roads on the south end. They would come on the ranch and pull some chain link along miles and miles and miles of this trail so that they could fly or look and find footprints and know, you know, kind of try to catch people. And October, November, we'd be out there hunting or working early in the morning. And you see those folks out there moving around. I mean, they were moving in the cool. Man, I tell you what, full moon, October, November, there was folks coming through. They were coming across that ranch because that Piloncilla was a landmark for them. It would help navigate them. And there was a couple of places we found.
Hot topic right now in the world.
Well, you know, I'm going to tell you, don't get me to talking about it because, you know, I'll talk about it. I work down in Mexico a lot. And it is not the hot button topic down there that the mainstream media is making it out to be. Most, if not all, of the Mexicans I work with, they're in support of a wall. Hell yeah, build a wall. You know why, Rocky? Same reason you would be in support if you were them, because the people I work with, they don't spend a little money. They spend a lot of money giving their kids an education, a good education, to build a better life. And to hear somebody down in old Mexico today, last year, tell me this story. Why? Hell yeah, build a wall. We're all in support of building a wall. Because why should I send my son to school, my son does well in school, maybe he qualifies for to get the proper paperwork, and he goes to the United States and gets a real education, and he becomes employable in the greatest country in the world. Why should he have to compete with somebody that snuck across the border and didn't play by the rules like we did? That's as Republican and conservative an answer to get in support of building a wall if you're a Mexican. That's what the mainstream media is not saying, Rocky. Because you know their agenda. You said, I watched this morning on Today Show, they're all against Trump and the building the wall and the government shutdown, blah, blah, blah. Come on. Man, everybody's in support of that wall. Because it's the right way to do it. But now, I'm going to tell you this and share my idealistic side with you. Folks in Mexico work. There ain't no social support system. That's why when you pull up to a red light in Obregon, some guy jumps out. You don't ask him to. He jumps out of the shadows and starts washing your window with a broken piece of squeegee and a water bottle and some soap in it. And he washes your window because it's dirty. And he hopes that for having done the effort, you'll drop a few pesos out the window in his hand because that's what he's got to eat on. He does the work and hopes you're the guy that'll give him a few pesos. And a few pesos ain't much, Rocky. we're talking dropping 3 or 4 cents in his hands or a quarter. You know what I'm saying? He ain't asking for it. He's working for it. And that's been my experience. You know, back when I was working with Fish and Wildlife Service and we were doing all them, had a lot of immigrant labor coming in, green card labor doing hardwood trees, them son of a guns worked. I mean worked for pennies. And we're proud to have it, glad to have a job. And for that reason, golly, man, I'm all about letting them through. You know, my whole politics are, you know, hey, make me president. You think the world hates Donald Trump? They'll hate Ramsey Russell. I'd probably fire half the government and keep the ones I had. Take, here's a card table. Go down and find a trail. When them folks come across, here's their citizenship. Here's a work list. Give them a job. Let them pay into the system. All they want to do is work, Rocky. They want to work. That's what the ones I know, and I mean, they want a job. They want a future because down in Mexico, they're making $10 a day working 12 hours. They come up here and make twice that. Huh? Well, they can make a lot more than that just working. Working.
Well, we need to finish this story up next week, but I've got a better idea.
Now let me wait. I want to end this story with one story because I don't want to end on that note. I want to end on this note. We're talking about Mexico. We're talking about the wall. We got sidetracked on that.
Let me say this. You make people hungry enough in this country, they're going to work. They'll plant a tree.
This is a 2-minute story.
Go ahead.
Pat Pitt and I went down to old Mexico, eastern Mexico one time. One of my favorite trips I ever did with Pat. Pat's a turkey hunter, man. You think he's a duck hunter? That guy's a turkey hunter. Oh, he's a duck hunter, but he is a turkey hunter. He and I went isolated turkey hunting down in eastern Mexico one time, stayed in this little village called Ticmacui, poor beyond poor. A lot of the towns and houses and town and stuff didn't even have doors. You know, it was just simple and poor. And Pat made a comment one time, like, you know, he wondered what, you know, this little girl walked across the street with a baby, and he just wondered what their future was. And I said, I don't know, Pat, but they're smiling. Have you noticed that everybody down here smiles when they talk to you? They smile. So one day we'd been out turkey hunting that morning. We were coming into town, this little dirt road town. You know, the police car was sitting in front of the police station. It had an inch of dust on it. It hadn't been cranked in a month because there wasn't no crime to speak of down there, just a simple little country town. And walking up ahead of us was a guy pulling a hand cart with one of them big 5-gallon things of water on, one of them big commercial water jugs. He's walking down, but he's kind of listening. He's kind of walking to the right, and he'll stop at the curb and line himself up. He'll start walking forward and walk to the left till he hits the other curb. Very odd. And my host, our host, said something to me in Spanish. The translator said, that's, I can't remember the guy's name, Juan Miguel, whoever, most beloved man in Ticmacui, and I'd like you to meet him. I said, sure, we want to meet him. So he took a left, went way around a couple of blocks, and we got up to where the guy's coming to us now instead of away from us, and we stopped. We got out of the car, and we stood. And this guy's making his way to us, and there's a speed bump. He's like, tips over it and crawls over it, and he starts walking fast again until he gets all the way to the right curb. Lined himself up, begins to walk to us, gets to the left curb. Very odd pattern of walking. Well, as he gets up close to us, he ain't got glasses on. I realize this man's eyes all messed up. He's blind since birth. So we start talking. There was 400 doors, businesses, houses, homes, whatever, in the town of Ticmacui. This was the year Obama got elected, by the way. And we start talking to him in Spanish. And blind since birth, this man's job, his work, he delivers water. He lives just outside of town in a little house that's built of wood that had been cut and lashed together and then dried. So there's little cracks. If you drive by at night and they got a candle lit, you can see right in their house, him and his mama. But his job is, you can't drink the water down there. He goes to town every day. He goes to the water store. Here's your order. You know, so-and-so ordered this water. He puts it on his hand cart, and he delivers it to 400 doors in this little dirt road town. A blind man delivers water to every door in that town. It was unbelievable. It was unbelievable, Rocky. I mean, here's a Obama's getting in office. He's going to redistribute American wealth, blah, 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 blah. And here's a blind man in Mexico that delivers water to 400 doors for maybe $10 a day. And Pat pulled out $20. And he put it in the man's pocket, and he patted him on the chest, and he says, I just put $20 in your pocket, and it's not charity. It's not charity. He said that, but that was a very inspirational story. And I just wanted to give it to you. May God bless you. And for the first time in that man, in that conversation, when Pat said, may God bless you, the man's smile dropped. And he said, because he was confused, he goes, sir, God has blessed me. I'm the blind man that has the most important job in my town. I deliver water to every house. That's a heck of a story now. But here comes the rest of the part. That same year, there was a man named Carlos Slim who bought Mexican Telefonica and started making cell phones, and very briefly was the richest man in the world. Probably because of the Obama phone. That's where they got him from Carlos Slim. Was the wealthiest man in the world. And when he was announced the wealthiest man in the world and did the press interview, CNN or somebody stuck a mic in his face and said, what will be your charity? What Carlos Slim said is, Santa Claus is a children's myth. My gift to my people is work. My people want to work. So, Rocky, I'm just saying, not being all political and everything else, but, man, labor in America is woefully in high demand. And if you ask old Ramsey Ross, heck yeah, let's build this wall. Let's start getting some people in this country that want to come to our country like the folks did to start with, to work. Heck yeah, anybody wants to work, welcome in my country. You know what I'm saying? But just come through the right channels. You know what I'm saying? I just thought that was a heck of a story.
When we pick this story back up next week, I want you to think on this when it comes to deer management. I know this from managing goats, that the doe has more influence on your males than the actual buck does.
That's what they say, and genetics ain't my strong point. You know,
we spend so much time shooting these bucks, managing bucks, but yet you don't ever hear anything when it comes to managing does.
No, but how would you know? See, that's the whole rub. I've heard that for a long time, that does have a lot of genetic influence, but unless you're in a controlled environment with tags and numbers, how do you really protect a doe? Because what you got to shoot is a doe. You got to remove does from a landscape. Antlers are easy to manage for. And really, you know, in the state of Mississippi especially, man, you think about this, Rocky. I said this back in the 90s, working with them boys down in Texas, especially those Texas down there. I said, this godforsaken drought-induced country down here, man, if Mississippi would ever commit themselves to trophy deer management, I said this in 90, like the state of Texas, which is all about age structure, we would have something. Well, you know what, Rocky? One of the largest deer in the world, the largest non-typical whitetail ever shot by a man on score, was right there from Winston County, Mississippi.
Oh, yeah.
We got big deer. It's all about age structure.
I agree with that.
You know, but anyway, look, we visit this. We got a lot to talk about Texas deer hunting next time if you want to talk about it again. But
we're going to finish the story.
I've got to go sell me some duck hunting.
I've got to go because I'm going to get people pounded. Watch out, run that long. Really? Timer of all of these podcast guests?
Yeah.
I got a complaint.
I enjoyed it, Rocky.
Oh, yeah, man. I enjoyed it, Ramsey. Thank you again for being here. We want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line Podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.